From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Today we talk with Michigan Radio's investigative reporter Lindsay Smith about a proposal that might require all lead water pipes in Michigan be removed.
A lot of the talk in the next few weeks as this kind of gets hashed out is going to be, how do we pay for this and is it worth it?
If you're putting together a team for a project, you might want to take advantage of the diversity bonus.
The best team will typically consist of talented, diverse people as opposed to sort of quote-unquote the best people.
We sit down with three new teachers and have a frank talk about their profession.
We're not just teaching them music or math. We're teaching them how to be people.
And the British are coming to Detroit.
Basically, we love the music of Detroit.
We'll hear about the Detroit Agogo Festival. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. The fallout of the Flint water crisis continues. Now the state is considering requiring all lead water lines across Michigan be removed at no cost to homeowners, but the price tag of that is unimaginable. And that's just part of the changes. Here to tell us more about that is Michigan Radio investigative reporter Lindsay Smith. She obtained a copy of the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality proposal. If these new regulations are adopted by the state, they'd really be unprecedented, but they're still in draft form. So, Lindsay, what can you tell us about what the state is proposing?
These are wide-reaching changes. They are very detailed, pretty complex, and they are going to change a lot of things. How and how often communities have to test for lead in their water. The state wants a lot more information about where lead lines are in systems, and they want the public to have some access to that. A lot more on health notices about lead in water to folks that have lead service lines. And they're talking about lowering the so-called action level. This is the level that is a federal rule that says how much is allowable in a community's water
system. Yeah, it's 15
system.
parts per billion.
Yep, but we've been talking about it for a while, going to 10, yeah. Right? And that's not a health-based standard. I mean, you don't really want any lead in your water, but generally accepted that there's going to be some in certain areas. But the biggest thing is going to be that the state wants, as you said, water systems to eventually replace all lead pipes, even if samples don't show an elevated level in lead. I mean, that is really unprecedented.
I'm wondering what the water system operators have to say about all those changes.
They are very opinionated. I mean, some of them will say, you know, off the record that they feel like they're getting kind of the brunt of the Flint water crisis in some aspects, like sort of unfairly being punished for what happened in Flint. But most of them do recognize, they'll say that, you know, I'll follow the rules, and the rules probably do need to be updated. We've learned a lot in the past 20, 25 years since the law passed. But this goes even further than that. I mean, if cities have to find money to replace all of these lead lines, especially if they have to replace them on private property.
Oh, this is an unfunded mandate?
They are not going to be happy. I can't tell you how many times I have heard the words unfunded mandate come out of water operators' mouths. You know, Detroit has estimated, for an example, 125,000 lead service lines, by far the most in the state. I talked to Palencia Mobley. She's the deputy director of Detroit's Water and Sewer Department. I talked to her over the summer, and I asked her then, I mean, let's be real, could Detroit ever replace all of its lead lines?
I mean, no, right? It literally, the estimate to replace service lines is equivalent to what we're planning to spend on water main replacement and sewer rehabilitation over the next 5 years, $400 to $500 million.
That's combined just for the lead service lines. I mean, that's in a city with a good chunk of the population at or below the poverty level that's already struggling with water affordability issues. And Mobley and other water operators are telling me you can't ignore these real costs. And I think a lot of the talk in the next few weeks as this kind of gets hashed out is going to be, how do we pay for this and is it worth it?
And that's what I want to know. Is it worth that huge cost? I mean, are we going to improve public health that much to justify the expense?
Well, there's a ton of variables because it totally matters where you are. If you're in a city like Oak Park and there are only 9 service lines, lead service lines left in the ground, it's an easier decision. When you're talking about Detroit or Pontiac or Saginaw or Battle Creek, it becomes more difficult. The common scenario right now is that we are already replacing some lead service lines as we do water main work, just general updating. These lines are old, even if they didn't have a health hazard. But the way we're doing it, we're still leaving most of the time a big chunk of lead in the ground, and that's on private property. And the science is really coming around and saying that's a health hazard. That could be, in some cases, worse of a health hazard than simply leaving the full lead service line in the ground. I think there are definitely health advantages to making some of these changes, but the problem is it's hard to make a blanket change this big and make it worth it everywhere.
As we noted, this is a draft. Who makes the final decisions, and when could it become a mandate?
The DEQ is going to make the final decision. Right now it's a draft. They're getting feedback from water system operators and other stakeholders. I imagine that will be a very lively meeting on Monday, and they have a couple more scheduled. But I think we're going to see a more finalized draft come out at the end of November, and perhaps it will get adopted at some point next year. We'll have to wait and see how quick it goes.
That's our investigative reporter, Lindsay Smith. Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Today is the deadline to turn in proposals to lure Amazon's second headquarters. Cities around this nation have been putting together their bids. And his column in the Detroit News, Daniel Howe, says Detroit's bid shows a remarkable level of cooperation between Michigan business and political leaders. Daniel joins us now. How so? How have they been cooperating?
You know, I've spent a lot of time over the last however many years, back in the early 2000s, covering this business community and leadership in general, including the build-up to the Super Bowl in Detroit in 2006. And what I see here is a remarkable alignment between business leaders of varying shapes and sizes and stripes, local politicians, state government, Republicans and Democrats, all kind of working together to see if they can put Detroit's or Southeast Michigan's best foot forward. Do I think that they're going to be at the top of the list? I'm not prepared to say that. I think there are a lot of people that think, in fact, Detroit won't be, and have said as much and written as much and used analysis to come to that conclusion. But I do think what's important here is the exercise that they're going through or have gone through in trying to pull together.
The one point you didn't mention just now, but you put in your column, is this is a binational bid pulled in the city of Windsor, the province of Ontario. How helpful is that?
I don't think we know. I think what these guys have come, men and women have done, is try to say, how do we differentiate ourselves? As I understand it, what Amazon is looking for mostly in this first round is what makes these various communities tick. Why are they different? Why are they special? And I think that the Detroit group goes into this thing thinking that they are the only metropolitan area that is going to be able to put forth a binational bid. Southern Ontario really is the heart of business and commerce in all of Canada, and it has a lot to offer. So I think what they're trying to look at is say, how can we differentiate ourselves? And this is one way to do it.
Hey, Daniel, remind us what is at stake with this Amazon bid.
Well, Amazon has said we're going to invest $5 billion. We're going to create 50,000 jobs over a fairly extended period. It's not going to happen overnight. And those jobs, on average, will pay $100,000 a year. Those numbers alone are kind of staggering. I mean, any community, any economy or local or regional economy that has to absorb 50,000 jobs, it's not going to be easy. And I don't care if you're talking about a New York or a Chicago or a Detroit or a Denver or whatever. That's a big chunk. And that also creates a lot of challenges on a local and regional level for infrastructure, utilities, bridges, roads, schools, police and fire, all sorts of ancillary things that, by the way, do cost money. And when you bring those people in, you have to deal with them. I mean, I think the other thing that they recognize is that Detroit does not have the kind of mass transit that you do see in other parts of the country. And some of the analysis going into this has suggested that that's one of the big Achilles heels of Metro Detroit. And I think that's a fair criticism. The question is, would they be able to address that? And I think that's part of what they would like to do if they get the opportunity.
Cities and states have been ratcheting up incentives to lure business, usually manufacturers. At what point is that self-defeating?
Oh, I think we're probably already there. I mean, in the sense, you see in Wisconsin, they put forth $3 billion incentive package to lure Foxconn Technology, which is the largest contract manufacturer in the world based out of Taiwan, and they won. And of that $3 billion incentive package, about $2.85 billion was cash incentives. We're moving into a period right now where companies are saying they have no qualms about publicly pitting states, regions, and cities against each other. Foxconn has done it. Amazon is doing it now. Toyota and Mazda have done it, which is really rare in the auto industry. They've basically said, we want to build a plant in the United States and give us your best offer. And this turns all of economic development upside down. It creates a lot of public pressure on the people who are traditionally doing this kind of work behind the scenes. In the state of Michigan, it would be the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. It would be the governor's office. It would be county and even city economic development groups. Most of this work is always done privately because doing it publicly always ratchets up not only the stakes, but the costs. Land acquisition, a lot of other things. All of a sudden, somebody's like, oh, you would like to build a plant on my property? Okay, well, now it's going to be X times higher and more expensive for you to acquire.
I imagine every city, every region that bid probably feels it has a real chance, but that chance is essentially 1 in 100. Right. Is there some other value to all these people and entities working together on this Amazon Headquarters 2 proposal that can be used in the future?
Absolutely. And I think that's really one of the most important things here. I mean, when you have alignment between, you know, auto companies and suppliers and university presence and politicians on, in both parties, I mean, I think that's a really important point here in a somewhat polarized political situation here in Michigan and around the country. Think of this as kind of a muscle memory kind of thing. If you start doing this and you're able to convene these people for other opportunities. Let's say we're down the road a couple more months and the Foxconn thing is now ripe and ready to go because Michigan is in the hunt for another Foxconn investment. They have assembled some of these people, and that kind of unity can be attractive to a would-be employer as opposed to communities that are warring with each other. I think one of the concerns was that, for example, Oakland County was going to try to put forth their own bid. And I think the belief is that if you have regions that split up and have competing bids, they would probably get kicked out by an Amazon or by other companies that are looking to come to a community like this.
Daniel Howes is business columnist with the Detroit News and a regular contributor to Michigan Radio. Hey, good to talk to you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up, what's it like to be a young teacher in Michigan right now?
Without teachers, there wouldn't be doctors or lawyers or politicians or any of those important things that are paid 4 times the amount that we are. How am I expected to stay here?
The compensation does not equate. You have to have a passion and a burden or a love for the students or education in order to do it, especially in this climate today. There's no other way.
That's in 20 minutes here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham.
Collaborative.
Experimentation.
The next idea.
We need a participation revolution, and we need it fast.
Let's say your boss wants you to assemble a team to work on a complex problem at your company or your agency or your nonprofit. Now, you think about your best and brightest people with some knowledge of the problem, and you buy them some bagels and coffee, and then you all get together, right? Well, you might not be approaching this kind of problem solving in the best way. Here to talk about that is Scott Page. He is the author of the book, The Diversity Bonus. Welcome to The Next Idea.
Thanks. Great to be here.
I think our instinct is to get the smartest people in the room, right, and get to work. Why is that not the best approach?
It's not the best approach because the problems we face today are complex. They're high dimensional, they're nonlinear, they're difficult to solve. And so the best team will typically consist of talented, diverse people as opposed to sort of, quote unquote, the best people.
So when you say diverse, I mean, we think of identity diversity,
right?
Like black and white. So it's race, it's religion, it's ethnicity. That's not what you're talking
Gender,
about.
Gender, physical ability, that sort of stuff. Yeah, so in the book, there's two levels of argumentation. The first is when you're dealing with a complex problem, you need cognitive diversity. You need people who see the problem differently. You need people who know different ways of attacking the problem, bring different models to bear, bring different perspectives, those sorts of things. So the question is, where does that come from? Like, you know, how do you seek out cognitive diversity? And what you find is that cognitive diversity tends to come in different identity packages. So you want people who not only were trained differently and have different experiences, you also want people who come from different identity groups, typically. I mean, it's going to depend on the problem, right? So some problems, identity is going to matter a lot. Like if we're designing a healthcare policy, if we're thinking about environmental policy, if you're talking about the lottery, you want people who sort of come from different places thinking about how do we design this policy? How do we solve this problem? How do we make this evaluation? In other cases, if it's more of an engineering problem, identity may matter less.
So I'm a manager, a mid-level manager. I've been told to put together a team. I want to put this into practice. How do I tell whether I've got cognitive diversity in my team? I mean, I don't know all of these people that well.
Right. I think that's the real challenge here is when you think about team composition, you've got to sit back and really thoughtfully imagine what are the sort of sets of skills, experiences, understandings, backgrounds that might be useful in constructing a team. One of the examples I give in the book is, you know, 150 years ago, it's a Michigan logging camp, and I'm going to hire people to chop down trees. That's a pretty simple hiring task. I line people up, I see who's best at chopping down trees, and I hire those people. Actually, they do one other thing. They count your teeth because you had to have enough teeth to be able to eat enough meat to continue to chop down trees the next
okay.
day.
All right.
But essentially, like, ability is well-defined, right? And so the quality of the team or the performance of the team is like the sum of the individual parts, right? If you think of putting a team together, you know, think of like when Target moved into Canada. This is one of my neighbors, Jay Grusin, gives us an example of a failure of diversity.
You're talking about Target, the retailer.
Yeah, okay. They moved into Canada, and they had someone who's great at marketing move in, but they didn't have anybody with any understanding of logistics, really, who moved in. And so it was a logistics nightmare. You might not know, but Canada uses the metric system. You know, so a lot of boxes were falling off shelves. So it's just an example where when you think about any sort of business decision, there might be, you know, human resource aspects, there might be organizational aspects, there might be logistic aspects, there might be environmental issues. There's all these dimensions to a problem, to a task. And if you're only looking through a few windows, if you're not looking sort of from multiple perspectives at that problem, anything you don't look at could go wrong.
So you don't know what you don't know.
You don't know what you don't know. And the other thing that when you get back to identity diversity, one thing that's interesting about sort of both identity diversity and background diversity is if I'm in a room with engineers or if I'm in a room with women, if you're in a room with people different from you, you tend to have to work through your arguments more carefully. If you and I have the same background or trained in the same way, I can say, oh, hey, markets work. And you're like, hey, yeah, you're right, markets work. We're economists, then we
move
on.
Yeah, there's no shorthand.
Yeah, but there's no shorthand. If there's a sociologist in the room, they're going to be like, wait a minute, markets don't always work here. And then you have to walk through the logic of do they work, and you might find out, ah, maybe we jumped to a conclusion that we shouldn't have. I think the other thing, when you think about populating teams, it's not only what you should do, it's what you should not do. So my friend Sheen Levine talks about the siren call of sameness, which is that like, hey, someone who looks like me and thinks like me, he's smart, right? And we tend to want to be in groups. It's more comfortable to be in groups of people who look like us and think like us. If you're dealing with a hard problem, what you want to do is you want to surround yourself with talented people who think differently than you do.
Let's step back for a second. I want to challenge you just a bit.
Yeah.
You've worked with places like Google, Boeing, Ford, NASA. Some of these places have been assembling teams for a long time. They have some experience at successful team building.
Right.
Why do you feel your cognitive diversity approach is better than whatever they've devised over the years?
Part of it, so each one of these places is seeking out cognitive diversity. So they'll do things like a place like Boeing or Northrop will make sure when they're putting people on a project that they've taken people who've worked on different projects. Because if I've worked on a plane and you've worked on a submarine, we've learned different lessons. And so if we're designing some new thing, you want both of us, right? And you want engineers who've gone to different schools, that sort of stuff, right?
So you're saying this is something they recognize,
they
just didn't have a name for it.
Well, they do have a name. They have a name for it, but they're each doing it sort of in different ways. And they're not worried about sort of drawing general lessons and sort of necessarily coming at this from a scientific perspective. They're more sort of brass tacks. How do we do this better? So if you go to a place like Google, one of the things that, like, they make hiring decisions, they make, you know, promotion decisions, they make salary decisions with teams of people, not with individuals, because they know teams do better. Everybody's constantly sort of pushing, how do we construct the best possible teams? What sort of diversity do we need? But the difference is, and this is, I think, what makes the problem just so fascinating from a scientific perspective, is what diversity is relevant depends on who you are. So if we go to Harrah's, I was talking about this in my class, that if we go to, you know, a big casino operation, they really care about quantitative diversity, quantitative people, and qualitative people, because they've got lots of data on how much people are winning. So they need people who are good at numbers. But those people aren't good at all the other things that are important in a casino, like entertainment, design, those sorts of things. When they put together a team, they're counting how many quantitative people are here, how many qualitative people are here, right? That's a key dimension of diversity to them. At a place like Boeing, it may be that everybody's quantitative. You know, there's not as much aesthetic concern with a tank or a submarine. It's mostly an engineering problem. So all these places are playing in this space, experimenting in this space, searching in this space. How do we construct the most innovative, amazing team? So Astro Teller, who runs Google X, they're like cutting edge thing. He has these wonderful quotes about how, like, diversity is not some touchy-feely, you know, oh, it's the right thing to do sort of thing. Diversity is what really drives innovation at Google, and they're constantly challenged, as is Northrop, as is Boeing, as is Ford, as is NASA, to think about what sort of diverse teams are the most fertile. The point, though, is that what's the most fertile at Harrah's is not what's the most fertile at Google, and it's also not what's the most fertile at the Fed. You need different types of diversity for different problems.
So tell me, how do you tell? What evidence do you look at to determine whether teams with cognitive diversity actually produce better results than simply putting together the team of your best and brightest?
You know, I came at this as a trained as an academic theorist. So I was one of those professors at Michigan who sits around and writes things in white chalk on chalkboards and said, there, I proved it. And over the last decade, I've been out visiting, you know, hundreds of organizations and talking to them and looking at their data. And there's also been a lot of like large scale academic studies looking at like every paper ever published, every patent ever produced, those sorts of things, looking at tens of thousands of predictions by economists. And one of the things you see when you look across this sort of landscape of just massive data that didn't exist a decade ago is two things, that more talented teams do better, which is what we'd expect, and more diverse teams do better, which is what we'd expect. But the bonus, the reason I call the book The Diversity Bonus, the bonus from diversity exceeds what we would have thought of. So let me just give sort of one example with respect to prediction. If you invest in stocks, if one stock returns 10%, the other stock returns 6%, on average you get 8%. If two people make predictions and you're like, suppose the average person makes an error of like 100 or something and you're 10% better and I'm only 8% better, you'd think if you averaged our predictions, we'd be 9% better. That's not true because the thing is with predictions, there's actually, you can prove this mathematically, which I show in the book, there's a bonus because it could be that if we're wrong in opposite directions, like you're a little bit too high, those errors, that diversity will kind of cancel out and we do better. So it turns out I'm looking at, this is one of the examples of like 50,000 forecast. The very best economist is 10% better than the average economist. The second best economist is 9% better. If you average the two of them, you get 18% better, right? Which is like totally counterintuitive because we tend to think of diversity from a portfolio perspective, not from a bonus perspective. And so what I show in the book is all sorts of sort of empirical examples where this bonus exists. And to be honest, you know, the Mellon Foundation asked me to write the book. If I could have made up the data 10 years ago, somebody said, hey, Scott, make up your own data, I wouldn't have dared make up some of this data. No, I mean, just
that outlandish.
Yeah, because if you'd have said to me, how much better would adding the second best economist be? I'd have said, yeah, maybe you go from 10 to 12. Because, you know mathematically there's got to be a little bonus. But the fact that it goes from 10 to 18 just
throws everybody off.
Yeah, but the reason it does, again, is that, like, you know, you've got a fancy model, I've got a fancy model. If it turns out when you happen to be high, mine happens to be low, because we're looking at the world in different ways, this is why it's all about diversity, collectively we do really, really well.
I got a couple of kids in college now, and I often hear just how much they hate working with a team of fellow students for all the reasons you think. You know, they don't show up, they don't share the work, they don't bring anything to the table. So if you're working at a place where it seems that teams are just as dysfunctional as these student teams, how can they achieve better results with this concept of diversity bonus in mind?
I think one of the most perplexing aspects in thinking about diversity bonuses and thinking about diverse groups is this. If we're in a group of people who all are trained in the same way, think in the same way, we're really likely to agree. And so we're likely to walk out of that meeting saying, that was a great meeting. We just had an excellent choice. And we don't see the counterfactual. If I'm in a meeting with a whole bunch of people who think differently than I do, then I'm going to lose the vote sometimes. It's not going to be 7-0, 7-0, 7-0, 6-1, right? It's going to be 4-3 or 3-3-1 or 3-2-2, and I'm going to lose. So I'm going to walk out of that meeting and thinking, darn it, I thought this was the best thing, but in fact, we're doing something else. I think that's a mistake. So the lived experience, and so in the book, there's a follow-up by Catherine Phillips, a friend of mine wrote in the book sort of a critique of the book, and one of the points she brings up in her research is that it's not necessarily more fun being in a diverse group, and it's not necessarily the case that you think you do better. So she has this wonderful experiment where people vote on how good they think their groups are. The diverse groups do better, but people with the homogeneous groups think their groups are better because everybody agrees with them. And so the funny thing is, if the group never disagrees with you, it can't be smarter than you, and you didn't need the group, right? That's the thing you got to remember. So like, if you walk out of a meeting and you get outvoted, you just have to say, well, unless I'm suddenly took some smart pill and I never make a mistake, that was probably a good thing, right? But that's a very hard place to be at, right?
That gets into Thaler's rationality.
Yeah. No. This is what, right, self-confirming biases and all that sort of stuff. But I mean, it gets back to this idea of this kind of like siren call of sameness in the sense that it's just kind of easier to be with people and understand people who think like you and make the same choices as you, and you all agree and you all feel confident in that.
But you might not have
overwhelming evidence
results.
Shows you're more likely to fail. Homogeneity is like the route to a B minus. You know, I mean, all the amazing stuff, I mean, Hamilton, the play, look at all the any like really amazing things. It's typically coming from diverse sets of people.
Scott Page is the author of the book, The Diversity Bonus. He's also a professor of complex systems, political science, and economics at the University of Michigan. Thanks for joining us on The Next Idea.
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
A British invasion is coming to Detroit. This week, a 5-day music festival kicks off in the city. Detroit A-Go-Go was organized by Phil Dick, and he joins us now via Skype. I understand 300 fans from Britain are making the trek to Detroit for this festival. Why?
Well, just about 300 of us are coming over from Britain for this festival. Basically, we love the music of Detroit, in particular the soul and Motown music of the 1960s and 70s. It's really, really big over here in the UK and has been for over 40 years.
So why? How did that come about?
Well, when Motown first broke in the UK in the early 60s and some of the Motown artists did a tour, it just kind of struck a chord with us here in the UK. We like the sound, we like the rhythm, we like the beat, and we've just kept on liking that kind of music ever since.
So name some of the artists that are favorites there in Northern Britain.
Well, we've got the Capitals. The Contours. The Dynamics. The Dramatics. Ha! What you see is what you get. It's what you get. What you see is what you get. It's what you get. The Adorables. Gins. Yvonne Vanee, The Professionals, The Fabulous Peps, the list just goes on and on.
So who might you see at the Detroit A-Go-Go Festival?
Well, you'll see all of those that I just mentioned, and additionally, you'll see Kim Weston, you'll see Carolyn Crawford, you'll see Toby Lark, who a lot of your listeners may not be familiar with, but she did a couple of tours in the UK, iconic records back in the 60s, and she was over here in the UK a couple of weeks ago, and she played to 3,500 people.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. So this is not just a music festival, I mean, in that it's going to be a lot of concerts. You're also going to be doing some tours. What are you going to see?
Well, we're going to see locations of the old recording studios in Detroit, and we're doing a big private tour of the Motown Museum, which holds a really special place in my heart, because I was married there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So, I take it for a lot of these visitors, it's going to be a once-in-a-lifetime trip in homage to this genre of music.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, many people are using their life savings to put into this trip. You know, it really is going to be a once-in-a-lifetime because a lot of the artists are getting older, but so are we.
So what do you expect to be the highlight for most of the fans?
It's hard to say. I mean, there are going to be many different highlights for many different people. I mean, for me, one of the great things is going to be getting to see the Capitals performing Cool Jerk live on stage. That will be absolutely amazing.
I remember that song from a long time ago when I was a radio DJ at a 50s radio show, and I'm not that old.
It was made famous again in Home Alone, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. That is Phil Dick. He's the organizer of the Detroit A-Go-Go Festival being held this week in Detroit. I hope you guys have a great time.
Yeah, we will. Be sure to come along.
You can find more information about Detroit A-Go-Go if you go to michiganradio.org. Thank you very much, Phil.
Fantastic. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Enrollment in teacher preparation programs is down in Michigan. Fewer people are choosing to become teachers. We've also heard reports in the last few years that some of the state's newest teachers aren't sticking around. They are leaving the profession. That got us thinking, what's it like to be a young teacher in Michigan right now? I sat down with these three to figure it out.
So I'm Ode DeBaja. I teach English language arts at Fortson High School in Dearborn, Michigan.
My name is Keisha Dukes, and I am an emotional impairment teacher at Erickson Elementary School in Ypsilanti, Michigan.
I'm Allison Vernon. I teach elementary music at University Hills Elementary in Rochester.
So let's start out, given all the obstacles, number one, low pay, number two, some politicians don't like you and all the other things, why in the world would you become a teacher?
That's a really interesting question that actually was just brought up to me not too long ago in a new teacher forum. Everybody in the whole room agreed that we were teachers because we wanted to work with kids first. And all of that other stuff that you mentioned, the politics, the, you know, low pay, that all came second. But what's interesting is that when all of that stuff is put in front of you again, it can be hard to like come back to the kids, you know? It can be hard to come back to that desire to be with kids because so many things are standing in your way.
I recalled how my teachers made me feel in my classrooms. This was through high school, through college as well. And I thought to myself, if I could hold that position that they held at the head of the classroom, and if I could make one of my students feel the same way that I did in my classroom, I feel like it'd be worth it. It'd be a job that I'd be excited to go to every day.
Keisha, I wanted to ask you about this. This is a second career for you, and on top of that, you chose a pretty difficult job within the profession.
Yeah.
Why?
I felt there was a calling, like Mr. O'Day. I know the impact that teachers have had on me, and growing up in an urban area and working with people who are less fortunate. Coming from that background, I wanted to have the same impact that teachers had on my life. And it just so happens that I feel like there was a calling in the area of special needs, children with special needs, especially working with African-American students. There is an overrepresentation of African-American boys in the special ed arena. And I wanted to make a difference in that demographic.
You're all recent grads. You all went into college and the idea of being a teacher. Has the reality been anything close to what you imagined it might be?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I remember thinking, just like you thought, I'm going to get in and I'm going to make a big difference in kids' lives and it's going to be so great. But then you realize that like that internal motivation gets like pushed further and further down from the top, you know? And my student teaching experience, they set me up for success. And my college experience, they set me up for success. And then you get in front of a room of kids and there's nobody to set you up for success. But you. And so much of what you do depends on the kids you're standing in front of, you know, and the kids you're standing in front of have home issues. They've got not enough food. They've got not enough clothes. They've got parents who are fighting, and they've got all these things. And all you want to do is like wrap your arms around them and give them love. But there's 35 of them in one room, and then you're standing in front of them, you know. So there's so many things I think that, again, push me away from that expectation of what it was supposed to be like. I don't know if you guys have experienced the same thing, but that's where that's where my experience has been.
Absolutely. My particular experience is with dealing with children with behavioral disorders. They've had some type of trauma early on that impacts their ability to learn and function in a typical general ed setting. So I have these heightened behaviors, and you know, my idea coming into it was I'm going to just get in there and I'm going to love them and they'll be able to learn and they're going to relate to me and things like that. And I was not ready at all.
What made you decide you weren't ready? I mean, what happened?
Well, in my student teaching experience, I was more of the observer and I was assisting these professionals, so to speak. And when I got in there and I saw, you know, behaviors escalated to the point where the children were volatile and calling names to me directly and not to the other teacher, and I didn't have to intervene in any kind of way before. Now, I'm the person that's taking the brunt of all of this.
And there's no college class that can prepare you
for
that.
No, no.
I'll agree with you in that in every step of the way in my university experience here at U of M, I was completely set up for success. My student teaching experiences were great. My practicum experiences were great. The main difference that I thought to myself in my first week or so was this is a lot more lonely than I thought it'd be. After hours, during my prep hours, I remember just sitting in my classroom really alone thinking, wow, this is, I have all the support here in my building, but when you get that first few moments in your classroom where you're looking around and it's empty and you haven't really put up any decorations yet, pinned up any student work yet, and you're sitting there on your own ready for the planning you're about to do for the next day, the biggest shock that came to me was that, yeah, it's a lot more lonely than I thought it'd be.
Allison, this is your second year teaching, but you were not at Rochester last year.
No.
You went to a different school and you left. What happened?
I did, yeah. Last year, I taught in a very small district on the east side of Michigan. Struggling kids, struggling families, struggling school district. And I learned a lot about myself. I left last year in the summer thinking I was not going to be a teacher again. I was beaten down. I was discouraged. The kids I was working with needed so much more than I was able to give them, and I needed support. I had very little support. I had very little support as a new teacher. And so this position in Rochester that opened up has given me everything that I lacked the year before. I have support. I have more mentors and coaches than I could ever have use for. But I think so much of that is that, like, teaching is very, can be very lonely. You can feel very isolated. And if you don't have a support system behind you, mm-hmm. if your principal isn't behind you, if your colleagues aren't behind you, mm-hmm. you go to work every day feeling like, why am I doing this? It's too hard to go in and not be supported, you know, because the kids need you mm-hmm. and you need people behind you. You need people right. to help you. Yeah. So that was my big thing, was the lack of help.
Yeah.
When I hear a story like that, which unfortunately happens all too often, I thank my lucky stars that I'm back at my old high school, my alma mater.
Lucky you.
Yeah, because I've got old teachers coming up to me, past teachers, I shouldn't say old teachers. I've got past teachers coming up to me saying, whatever you need, let me know. My coordinators were past teachers of mine. Whatever you need, let me know. The administration, they're familiar with me. Again, whatever you need, just let me know. They're all here to help.
You know, a lot of people think, how hard can it be to be a teacher? I mean, all you have to do is go there, lay out the lesson plan, plus you get the summers off, you know? A lot of people feel that, you know, teaching is just a glorified babysitter
right.
That happens to help kids learn to read and do math. What are they missing?
Well, number one, it's definitely not a 9-to-5. I was accustomed to that being in the corporate world. When I got off at the end of the day, I was off. When I'm off now, I'm like, okay, now I need to lesson plan for at least the rest of the week. And that takes so many hours. There's no way, being a first-year teacher, that you're going to be able to build curriculum for a classroom and do it from the time the bell rings and they let out. So your hours are much more extended than the school day.
Now, Allison, you're a second-year teacher.
Yeah.
So you've done all your lessons planned. You have nothing to do this year.
Right, yeah. Well, the first year was, for me, was like I was just trying anything I could do to not drown in everything, you know? And I remember my professors were like, you really don't know how tired you're going to be. And I was like, okay, but I'm young and I've got energy. I'm ready. The joke was on me because I was asleep with my laptop and my lesson plans out by like 5:30 every night last year, like just dead, you know. This year things are easier, I will say that, but okay. It's not any less work. It's not any less time. And I think part of what people miss when they say, oh, you just have to go in and teach a lesson, they're missing the fact that, you know, we're not just teaching the kids English. We're not just teaching them music or math. We're teaching them how to be people. Mm-hmm. And that takes so much more time and love and energy. And if you just go in and you teach your material, the kids aren't going to learn. They don't learn from people they don't like. They don't learn from people they don't respect. And so you have to build those relationships. Absolutely. And building relationships is hard. And it takes situations with a kid being volatile with you to build that bridge, you know, and to build that trusting relationship. So much of it is, yeah, we are teaching material, but we're teaching them how to be people first before we're teaching them math.
Going off of that, I felt really comfortable in my ability to go in and build some relationships. The advice that I've gotten from other teachers was that'll come in due time. Once you get more comfortable around them, once you've had more exposure, that'll come. And with my personality, I thought, okay, I can do my best now, and I think I'd have a good grasp on building that relationship with my students. So my biggest obstacle I felt was, sure, you do think to yourself when you're not in the classroom, what's the big deal? You'll have that lesson plan ready, and you'll just have to stand and deliver it. But I have a curriculum that I'm going off of as well that was provided to me. So that's, I guess, the pool that I'm reaching from. But even with that, I still feel like every day I'm starting from scratch, and I've got to build 60 minutes times 5 from scratch every night. And because I haven't had the time, because this is my first year, it is every night. Mm-hmm. To me, that seems very magnanimous. That seems like a humongous hill to climb. It's a very Sisyphean struggle for me. So that was my experience of it, at least for these first 3 weeks.
That's because you've just been doing it a few weeks. I'm going to ask you a question you might not be able to answer. What happens when you walk away at the end of the day and say, wow, that was a good day? What makes it a good day? Or maybe you haven't had one yet.
No. I've had my theory was, and what I told a teacher whose room is right beside me, is that I approach it as like a 5-game series, if we're talking sports, where I don't have to sweep the week. I just got to win 3 out of 5. So that's my goal. And there are some days where I walk away thinking, you know what? Yeah, today was a good day. And the first thing when I go out to do my hall duty while the kids are walking in between classes, I'll look at the teacher next to me. I'm like, today's a good day. The hour is going smoothly. And I guess what makes it so is that I've prepared what I've had to do minute by minute. And even though the best laid plans, you know what they say about them, because I've prepared so well, even if something does go awry, I can run with it. And I've got the assessments planned. They're on task. And they walk out, and I can tell in their eyes and from their responses that they've got it. And then you also get that social interaction. If you build those blocks, then I think that's what makes a good day.
Mm. For me, I think when I'm working one-on-one with a student that has been struggling for so long, and I see a light bulb go off, even if it's just one student, if I know that there was something that clicked that wasn't clicking for them before, that was a good day for me.
Allison, what's a good day?
I mean, for me, I tend to find that no matter how hard I prepare, there's always going to be something that leads me in a direction that I had not planned to go, but it's the directions the kids maybe need to go. And so sometimes it's those mutual experiences of like, okay, you don't know that we need to go here. I didn't know that we need to go here, but we're going to do this together, you know? So it's kind of having those moments with the kids where I'm allowing them to teach me as much as they're allowing me to teach them. There's this mutual kind of relationship building. There's this mutual understanding. So I think those days tend to be my favorite. But also, yeah, having days where a kid wants to come up and tell me about how he watched The Yellow Submarine was a comment he told me today. I watched the Yellow Submarine video, and he knows I'm a music teacher. He found something to relate to me with, you know? So it's those little things that really make me feel like, okay, like I have a place in this kid's schema of life.
I want to use the three of you as the voice of young teachers in Michigan. What are the biggest obstacles to success for young Michigan teachers?
I think a lot of the discouragement comes from a higher level. It comes from places like the state or the district at the district level. And it all kind of trickles down to us. So I think for me, a big challenge is looking at that paycheck that comes in every 2 weeks and saying, okay, I have student loans. I have a car loan. I bought a house. Like, how am I expected to live? Like, a comfortable life. I don't have to be rich, but I would like to be able to pay for things
poverty level.
Right. How am I expected to live and to retire and have a healthy, happy life if I go to work at a job that can't support that? A very important job.
Absolutely.
Without teachers, there wouldn't be doctors or lawyers or politicians or any of those important things that are paid four times the amount that we are.
Right.
How am I expected to stay here?
Let me interject, because a lot of people think, wow, teachers get regular raises, they get step increases.
Not always, though.
They talk about, you know, the higher up teachers, the teachers have been there 20 years and have a master's degree, and how much they're getting paid, and all they're doing is just standing up in front of a classroom. So there are people who don't understand what you're saying.
Sure, and I will say that there is some truth to that. I will say I was in a district previously where our steps had been frozen for 10 years. So even the people at the top of the pay scale were still receiving no increase, no longevity pay, nothing, right? So you feel like you put in your time, you're putting in 50, 60 hours a week, and it doesn't matter.
Right.
It doesn't matter. It maybe matters to the kids, but not to your bosses, right?
I would have to agree that pay is definitely a big obstacle. As you know, I left the first career, and after going to school for close to 7 years, I went and looked at, you know, what my salary was, and I make $4,000 more than I did before.
So, again, this is where I feel incredibly fortunate. I earned a scholarship to attend the university here at Michigan, and I received all that I needed in order to get my degree and move forward into this career. And I live close to the school, so I don't have much debt to pay off. But I was thinking about some of my friends that I've graduated with who have moved on in other areas of the state, other areas of the country, even internationally. Thinking of the burden that's placed on them, the living costs, and everything else that comes with starting your new career. And I couldn't fathom how it would work out. I couldn't do the math. I don't need to be a math teacher in order to do that math, because it'll never add up.
So aside from money, what do you think should be changed to help young teachers in Michigan succeed?
I think that we need support from our administrators, and we need support from our communities too. A lot of our job happens within the community. We're community members who are trying to build the community, you know. And so if we don't feel supported from the community, from the district, from the state, you know, I think it becomes harder to do our job. We need support from our parents, because they're the people who are supporting the kids when
Absolutely.
We aren't, you know. I mean, we see the kids almost as much as their parents see them during the school year. So I think being in a district now where I do feel that kind of community support, I know that there are districts in Michigan who are not receiving that. And I think for teachers in those districts, doing your job can feel really impossible.
Right. There's a lot of demands and expectations that are placed on us as new teachers, standardized tests and evaluations that are met based on what the student scores are, and parental support is equally as important as a teacher's job, that we need that support from the parents.
Will you guys be teaching in 10 years?
I don't know. I hope so, because I think it's important. I feel like I finally feel after a year of teaching that I'm feeling fulfilled. Like, I'm excited to go to work. I'm excited to see the kids every day. So I hope that I'll still feel the way that I feel right now in 10 years.
I hope so too. I plan to.
I will say definitely. But my mindset is going to grow and change exponentially. But I definitely hope. Yeah.
We've been talking to Ode Dibaja. He's a first-year ninth grade language arts teacher at Fortson High School in Dearborn. Keisha Dukes is a first-year special education teacher at Erickson Elementary in Ypsilanti. And Allison Vernon is an elementary music teacher at Rochester Community Schools. And this is her second year of teaching, but her first at Rochester. Thanks very much for being so candid with us.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
That's our show for today. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Candy. Thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.